stress on the subject, the Bible and the Big Mac. Brother John.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The origin of the universe is a subject of considerable interest throughout the world. Generally accepted idea, of course, is that the universe came into existence as the result of a single creation event, which is known colloquially as the Big Bang. That's the idea that's taught in schools and in universities. It's depicted on television. It's generally accepted by the public. It's actually very, very good evidence for the existence of God. It's therefore a bit surprising to find that a fair number of people don't like the Big Bang theory. I suppose they don't really understand it. Somehow they're getting mixed up with philosophical evolutionism, which proclaims there's no creator. But in fact, there isn't a conflict between the Bible and real science. It's the atheists who have their work cut out in trying to find explanations in the face of scientific fact. So I want to start off with a little look at the history of thought on the origin of the universe. And if you start by tracing back, you find that in past ages the idea of a creation was rejected. In medieval times, the church adopted the ideas of Aristotle. That's Aristotle. Couldn't get a good photograph of Aristotle, so we have to make do with a statue. And he decided that the universe had not been created, but had always been in existence, had always been a universe. It didn't need, therefore, a creator. And that idea was very much ingrained as the church emerged from the Dark Ages into church teaching. This is Thomas Aquinas. He spent a lot of time working out how you could fix Aristotle and sort of reconcile it with church teaching. He did quite a good job in philosophical terms, but it didn't really quite match up. But it was so ingrained because of that that even scientists like Galileo or Kepler or Newton never questioned the idea that the universe had always been there. Newton is the third character up there. He grappled with the question of why his law of universal gravitation didn't result in the whole of the universe ending up together in a single mass, what my copy of Principia calls an heap, but as he wrote it in Latin, presumably it wasn't quite that. He solved this problem by showing that if the universe is infinite, then you don't have to worry about it, because you've got a star, my fist, you've got as much stuff on this side as you have on that side, and so the two pulls cancel out, and it doesn't affect the star at all. So if the universe is infinite, it doesn't have to collapse by gravity. So the idea of the universe is finite didn't occur to him. It was he presumed it had always been there. Now, the problem at that point came from a Danish astronomer, Heinrich Olbers. Well, he might be German, I think he comes from Schleswig-Holstein, which sort of shifts between the two, who thought about the problem of why the sky is dark at night. He's down as being the first astronomer to notice that it's dark at night. I suspect that other people had got in front of him on that one, but he actually thought about it. Most people just took it as a matter of course. He thought, why is the sky dark? And he reasoned that if you look out into the sky at night, it's an infinite universe, like Newton said, then your line of sight, no matter what line of sight you get, should end up at a star. And that should be true every possible direction. In which case, no matter which direction you look, the light should end up on a star, and hence the sky should be as bright as the sun. And of course you're going to be fried. Obviously it's not like that, and he wrote about the problem in 1823. Everyone was so convinced that the universe was infinitely old, the problem couldn't be solved. The real answer is it hasn't got time. No matter which direction you look, sooner or later you'll run out to a time when there weren't any stars. And in that case, the sky can be black. or maybe it's not infinitely big, in which case it would all collapse into a heap if it was infinitely old. So either way, it's not infinitely old. That's what that observation shows. But people couldn't tackle that. They thought, well, it's got to be infinite. It's got to be eternal infinite. So therefore, there's a bit of a paradox, isn't it? They call it Olbers' paradox. There's a second problem which became apparent toward the end of the 19th century, and that's the fact that stars still exist. Stars, of course, have a finite amount of fuel in them, which they burn up. And the fact they haven't used the fuel up shows they're not infinitely old. And it was Lord Kelvin that posed that problem. He didn't know about nuclear energy, so he worked out how long a star would burn on chemical energy, and it wasn't very long at all. Of course, later on, people have sort of almost ridicule. If you read Dawkins' book on the God Delusion, he goes to town ridiculing Kelvin because he had such a short age for a star. But the principle remains, the stars haven't used up their fuel. Okay, it's a bit longer than it would have been for them to burn out than it would have been if only the mechanisms Kelvin knew about were there. But nonetheless, they still shouldn't have a finite age, and they haven't burned out, so therefore the universe is not infinitely old. Well, at the start of the 20th century, there's a revolution in the understanding of the physical universe. 1905 is the big year. In that year, Albert Einstein published four groundbreaking papers. He outlined the ideas behind the theory of relativity, quantum theory. He showed that space and time were shaped and matter could be converted to energy and vice versa, and he produced the final proof for the existence of atoms. That all happened in 1905. And then 12 years later, he published an equation where he used his ideas of relativity to describe the size of the universe. And the solution to that equation shows a universe which is either expanding or contracting. Can't be static. Einstein was so used to the idea of an eternal universe, he couldn't believe his results, and he fudged his equations to give him a static solution. Didn't expand or contract. Later on, he described that as his biggest ever mistake. In 1927 now, this idea of a static universe was challenged by Georges Lemaître. Lemaître is a Christian, he's also a theoretical physicist. There he is talking to Einstein. Because the Bible describes a creation event, Lemaître was prepared to accept that the universe wasn't eternal, but that it expanded up from a creation event. And he was therefore prepared to accept the solution to Einstein's equations that predicted an expanding universe. And Lemaître published his conclusion, the idea that required a creation event, in 1927. That's one of the few occasions in which Bible teaching has led to a modern scientific theory. There were two in the 20th century, that was one of them. And by accepting the Bible at face value, Lemaître was able to advance the scientific understanding of the universe. Now, he published that in French in Brussels, and it didn't get a big readership straight off, but while it was being translated, Eddington ensured it was translated and spread around. It took a few years. While that was going on, this chap's Edwin Hubble, and he did some work on measuring the spectra of galaxies, published it in 1929. Now, the spectrum of a star or a galaxy, we all know how it works in school. So you end up with spreading your light out with a diffraction grating or a prism. At one end you get red, the other end you get violet, with all these other colours in between. But you also get a set of dark lines in the spectrum. If it passes through hot gas, that will absorb certain wavelengths of light, certain colours, and they come as black lines. And the black lines form a characteristic pattern that doesn't change, the same matter where what you look at. So if you're in a laboratory, you can do it and you get a set of lines. I've drawn random black lines on there. There are an awful lot more of them, and they won't be in those positions, but that's the idea. So what Hubble did was to measure that from different satellites, they're from different galaxies, and he found out that if you've got a nearby galaxy, then the lines a little bit near towards the red end of the spectrum. If it's a distant galaxy, they're rather further towards the red end. If it's a very distant galaxy, they're a long way towards the red end. And what's going on? Well, this is something called the Doppler effect. Doppler effect, you probably used to it more with sound. If you remember the days when fire engines went ba 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 like that, well, you used to hear them coming along, they and they dropped in tone when they went past. That's the Doppler effect. It's to do with the way that the wavelength's perceived as you approach and as you go away. Now, in the case of light, in the case of sound, you get if your sound is going away, then the tone drops, it gets lower than you'd expect. In the case of light, it gets more red. So if you see a car coming towards you and it's very blue, you know it's coming really, really fast, so you've got to get out of the way. When, say, the lecture's over and everyone gets out of the meeting room, you'll see them being redshifted as they head towards the door. But you want to see it very much because you have to go really fast when it's to get the redshift, and you have to go really fast to get the blue shift. But that's what's going on with galaxies. The further away they are, the faster they're travelling away from us. If you're twice as far away, then it goes twice as fast. Three times as far, it goes three times as fast. And what's happening is that the universe is expanding. It's all shooting out. And you can then, having spotted that, you can then think what it looks like. Well, if you work back, so in the present day, there it is, big universe, still getting bigger. If you go back, well, it was smaller in the past. If you go back a bit more, it was even smaller. Until, if you go back far enough, you end up with a point where it can't get any smaller, it was only one spot. And at some point after that, the universe must have come into existence. It's not clear exactly when it was, but it couldn't be before then. Einstein's equations that describe the universe, the solutions, the size of the universe, the solution says it gets smaller as time goes back. Or it might be collapsing. But one or the other, there are two solutions. But if you go back far enough, you reach a point where there's no solution. It's got back to zero and it can't go any further back. If you've got an equation that hasn't got a solution, that equation, mathematicians would say that equation was singular. So the bit where it can't go any further back and no more solution is called a singularity. You might hear them talking about that when people talk about the Big Bang on television or whatever. So at some point after that equation, or at that time, at the point where the equations fail, the universe must have come into existence. Now, that idea was published in 1927 by Lemaître. Hubble's evidence was published in 1929, but the atheists continued to reject it for decades after that on the grounds that it was too much like the biblical idea of creation. Even non-atheists who wanted their science to be kept separate from the idea of God were suspicious of it. You get some comments from various scientists, atheistic ones. That's one from Stephen Hawking. He says many people do not like the idea that time had a beginning, probably because it's an act of divine intervention. A chap called John Gribbin, writing in 1976, he's writing about the history of the way that the length of time it took before the idea of a creation was accepted. He said great impetus was given to the steady state theory, that's the alternative to the Big Bang, the idea that the universe is eternal, by the question raised by the idea of a beginning to the universe, in particular the question of what or who was responsible for it. So we've got scientific fact which is being resisted by atheists, mainly philosophers rather than scientists, because it's too much like creation. There's a chap called Sir John Maddox, another atheist, writing in 1989, so this is now a long time after the evidence of the Big Bang's out, and he's still trying to say that there isn't couldn't have been a Big Bang, couldn't have been a creation event. He described this idea of there being a beginning to the universe as being thoroughly unacceptable, because he said it applied an ultimate origin of our world and gave creationists ample justification for their beliefs. It's quite a long paper. I've summarised it very briefly there, but nevertheless, that's what he's saying. And Hubble himself, the chap who measured the red shifts, he never accepted the idea that there'd been a creation event. He always wrote that the universe appeared to be expanding. He never wrote that it actually was expanding. Eddington wrote that the notion of a beginning to the universe was repugnant. You know, this is the atheists don't like the idea of a Big Bang. The strongest objection came from this chap here, who is Fred Hoyle, later on Sir Fred Hoyle. He argued that the idea of a beginning to the universe must be unscientific because it resembled evidence, arguments for the existence of a creator. And he, together with two other atheistic scientists called Bondi and Gold, proposed as an alternative what we know as the steady state theory, where matter is created continuously to fill the void left by the expansion of the universe. And the only reason that he had for that was that the proponents of that theory were atheists at the time, wanted to avoid obvious evidence for the existence of a creator. And up till that point, it was known as a creation theory. We will be talking about the creation theory, not the Big Bang theory, but Hoyle coined the phrase. He went on a wireless program, on the third program in 1949, and he coined the phrase the Big Bang to describe the creation event. He protested afterwards he didn't do that to belittle the idea, but most cosmologists thought that's exactly why he did it, and one does have one's doubts. But without Hoyle's broadcast, we would have been talking about the creation theory, not about the Big Bang theory. Well, for a while there was a bit of debate over the merits of the Big Bang theory and its only competitor, which is the steady state theory, but the matter was effectively decided by some further items of evidence. First one is the relative abundance of different light element, chemical elements in the universe. And you can measure this from spectra. Basically, what makes an element, that particular element, is the number of protons in the nucleus. So if it's got one proton, it's hydrogen, but the two kinds of hydrogen, there's hydrogen on its own, just one proton, so the ordinary kind of hydrogen, there's heavy hydrogen, which has a proton and a neutron, so it's twice as heavy. Helium has two protons, and you get two kinds of that. Helium-4 is the most common kind, which has two protons and two neutrons. We also get helium-3, that's two protons and one neutron, and there's lithium in tiny traces, but which has got three protons. And you can calculate from the Big Bang theory the proportion of each of these different chemical elements that should exist in the universe. And it's right. Rather interesting, particularly this one shouldn't exist at all unless there's been a Big Bang, because everything that makes helium-3 destroys it even faster in stars. So the fact that any of that around at all shows that there has been a Big Bang. Deuterium's a similar thing. So what happened is they calculated what that should be based on the Big Bang, what the proportions of they should have in existence, and the answer they got was exactly right. So it's a prediction which is fulfilled. And then finally, the absolute clincher came with the discovery of cosmic microwave background radiation in the early universe. It would have been very hot when the universe was made, and the heat, as the universe expanded, the amount of heat would stay the same, but it would be spread out over a bigger volume, so it would feel cooler. And in the end, it goes down to being pretty cold out there. And these two people, these are Penzias and Wilson, and they were looking for radio interference in microwave communications for the Bell Telephone Company. And they had a telescope, which was just an ordinary microwave communications receiver. It could point in any direction. There it is behind. And they discovered that there was a sort of hiss of background radiation coming almost equally from every part of the sky. And, well, they had a problem with that, so they looked at the telescope, found there were some birds nesting in it. They thought that might be the cause of it, so they got rid of the birds, and then they cleaned out all the stuff the birds had left in the telescope. And the radiation was still there. And they'd found cosmic microwave background radiation. In 1964, they published the results, first major piece of evidence about that. I can't get a really good spectrum of it from the ground, but they used satellites. What happened is that the theoreticians sat there and said, well, if you've got this heat radiation getting cooler and cooler and cooler, in the end it would cool down so much, we might mainly microwaves, and it would have a particularly characteristic spectrum. So the intensity would change with the wave number, the wavelength, and the frequency wave number. And there you are, that's the theoretical prediction. It's also the observed amount. The two of them are so identical, I haven't got a line that is thin enough to show any difference. Very, very close match. And really that was the final piece of major evidence. The correspondence was exact. The prediction of the Big Bang theory exactly fits the evidence that you get when you measure the radiation from space. So sent another satellite up to have another go in 2001, got the same spectrum. In 2006, it produced a sort of map of the distribution of cosmic microwave background radiation, and it's coming from all over the sky. That looks quite like, well, quite a lot of difference between the sort of darkest blue bits there and the brightest red bits here, but that difference is one part in 100,000. So it's very much matched to show the tiniest variations. You should get tiny variations because that's where stars and galaxies and so on come from. And it's exactly as would be predicted. So again, the evidence is there that everything is exactly right for a universe that came into existence, that was created. So the Big Bang theory is the theory that the universe came into existence as the result of a creation event. And that understanding has replaced the idea that the universe has always existed, which is what people believed beforehand. And the evidence to support it's overwhelming. Everyone, apart from a very small number of diehard atheists, I suppose some American evangelicals, now accept that it happened. So let's see how that fits in with the Bible picture now. The important passage to consider is in Genesis chapter 1. And that begins the fairly clear statement of the origin of the universe. So let's look at that. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. And it starts off, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. Now we've just been looking at that. It goes on, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. Well, it starts off with a reference to what happened in the beginning. In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Now, if you then take that chapter as a chronological sequence, the heavens and the earth are created before the 6 days that appear later on in the chapter. In verse 2, you've got an earth which is, well, it says without form and void in the Authorized Version, but it exists. Then you get the 6 days, where it's populated with life. Now the words that are translated without form and void in the Authorized Version are slightly off target, as it were, or slightly different from what without form and void. The Hebrew is tohu vebohu, it means empty and waste. Nothing to do with the shape. Without form and void implies it was shapeless. But it doesn't say that. It says that the earth existed, but it basically nothing on it and not suitable for life. And nothing living on it, that is, not suitable for life at that point. And it doesn't say how it got there. Dr. Thomas surmised that it had at some point been inhabited by human-like creatures who became angels before the 6 days of creation. I don't know whether that was the case. But the indication in the Bible is certainly that the heavens and the earth were created before the days of Genesis chapter 1, possibly long before the Genesis chapter 1. If anyone actually knows any passages that would support this from elsewhere, I have a couple, but if you can let me know, I should be I'm trying to collect a catalogue of them, but I'm not getting very fast. Get there very fast. So if you let me know, it'll be useful. Anyway, the other issue then comes on in verses 14 to 16, the fourth day. Here, if you read verse 14, it says, God said, let there be lights in the firmament of heaven to divide the day from the night, let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth, and it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the less light to rule the night. He made the stars also. Now, what's going on there? It seems at the first sight to indicate the stars weren't there before the fourth day, but actually it doesn't say they were created then. And the Hebrew draws a distinction between the creation of the heavens and the earth and the appearance of the stars on the fourth day. So we put that verse up. The word that's translated as made doesn't say, it just says God said and it was so then. There's nothing, no word that describes how the stars or whatever came into existence, but it says God made the two great lights, and the word it there isn't the standard word that's used for creating. God, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The word is bara. Here it's the word asa, which is a word with, I think one could say, a very large number of different meanings. The word appears all over the place. It appears in verse 11 of Genesis 1, for example, where it talks about herb yielding seed and the fruit tree yielding fruit after its kind. The word yielding there, it doesn't imply created out from nothing. Or in Exodus 25, verse 9, whole list of these. Exodus 25, now verse 9, and he says, according as I show thee after the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all instruments thereof, even so shall you make it. The word show, not the word make. And the idea is the word asa tends to mean to bring something into a point where you can see it rather than to make it come into existence. So what seems to be going on here is that when the earth was made, and then at some point it was empty and void. It doesn't say in Genesis 1 how it got like that, whether it was always like that, or whether there was another creation like it beforehand. There might be you might have ideas about that, but it doesn't say that in Genesis 1. But then you've got an empty world, and it's presumably covered in dust or clouds or something like that. And on day one, the cloud clears a bit, and you can see light coming through. So there's now light and darkness. And then here on day four, it's now cleared, well, God has cleared it enough for you to see the things outside, see the stars and the sun and the moon, which weren't visible up to that point. And I think that shows basically how this picture of the creation works. Okay, well, what does it mean in terms of the existence of God? Well, before one launches into the argument, there are two ideas. First of all, we established the scientific evidence, and the Bible both tells that the universe came into existence as the result of a creation event. And there are two ideas that are useful in discussing what's going on. The first idea is the idea of something being contingent. Now, if you've got a contingency plan, then that means a plan that follows on from events. And the same words used in a slightly different way by philosophers, they talk about something being contingent. They mean it's something that doesn't have to be like it is, it's caused to be like it is by something else. So if you have an object which doesn't have to be like it is, then it's contingent. If it could just not exist at all, it would be contingent. If it's different from what it is, it could be contingent. So I got my notes here for this talk. They could be different. They don't have to be like they are. There's no logical reason why they should be like this. They could have a lot fewer spelling mistakes for a start. I could have written this talk quite differently, or I could have given a talk on something else. Or I might not even exist, it might not be a talk. There's these things. There's an explanation why I got these notes, which is that I wrote them. And you can look at me and say, well, you're contingent as well, at the time when you didn't exist, so there must be an explanation for why you exist. And so on. And one can keep on going back and talk about things that go before. The other kind of entity is called necessary, something that must logically exist. It can't not exist because it must exist logically, it has to. Nothing else will determine what it's like. It's a necessary entity is something that has to be exactly as it is. Okay. So let's think about that. First of all, we know that some things exist in this universe. Some contingent things exist. It's possible for those things not to exist because that's at the time the universe itself didn't exist. Or the time before which it didn't exist, I suppose, if one wants to be absolutely accurate. So it's possible for anything that you can think of in this universe to not exist. So everything in this universe is contingent. Right? I did have an atheist I was emailing who actually argued, to try and get out of this one, argued that he didn't exist. I emailed him back and said, who am I talking to then? He hasn't replied to that one, so. I don't know. So if you've got something which it's got the possibility of existing, but not existing but exists, it's contingent, then it has to have been caused to exist by something else. And if you keep on going back in the end, you've got to terminate, you don't want an infinite regress, you've got to terminate with something that exists because it exists, because it's a special kind of entity that doesn't need a cause. That's a necessary entity, and that's consistent with the idea of God. Now at this point, atheists have a tendency to try and defend themselves from that by a story that it's the end of a public lecture on astronomy, and an elderly lady stands up in the audience and says, "You're wrong, young man! The earth is supported on the back of a turtle." And the lecturer asks what the turtle's standing on to receive the answer, "Another turtle!" And then, "What's that standing on?" says the lecturer. And she said, the woman says, "You can't fool me, young man. From then on, it's turtles all the way down." And I'm not quite sure why atheists do. They tell you a lot, this story, but I'm not sure why, because actually the joke's on them. The point is that even an infinite tower of turtles can't support itself. It has to stand on something. If you've got just turtles, then they'll disappear and go downwards. Without a necessary entity at the start, no sequence of causes can support itself, not even an infinite one. If you've got a collection of contingent entities, things that need a cause, a collection of them, that needs a cause as well. Not one in the collection, that needs a cause. You add a second contingent entity that needs a cause to it, the collection now, two, needs a cause. Third one to it, third contingency, that means I've got another collection which needs a cause. I keep on doing that as long as I like. The collection of entities will still need a cause. Einstein described it as one definition of insanity, which is to keep on doing the same thing over and over again and expect a different answer. And in this case, it's going to go on forever. No matter how often I add another entity that needs a cause to that collection of entities that need causes, I'm going to have a collection that still needs a cause, and the universe is like that. I know all the things I can put into the universe that are made of the universe, and they're all contingent. They all need causes. So in the end, there has to be something that's outside the set of contingent entities, the universe, which doesn't need a cause, that can cause it. So if we add that into the the argument, the number four there, There's no need for an infinite regress. You can't have an infinite regress. So therefore, there has to be something that starts off in the beginning. Well, we can also deduce what this entity is like. So the Big Bang brought the universe into existence, not just the matter and the energy of the universe. He brought everything into existence. The laws of nature, for example, that govern the working of the universe. Things like time and space, they're part of the universe. God brought all that lot into existence. So God invented them all, God brought them into existence. So God isn't subject to the laws of nature. God made the laws of nature. God's outside the laws of nature. And that means also then that God isn't made of matter. He's not limited by space or by time. He's not, doesn't have to be in a single place, be all over the place. He isn't constrained to a single time. He can see future and past events. God is eternal. And he's without limit. The only limits that God has are limits he's placed on himself. He's chosen not to do certain things, but that's God's choice. There's nothing else, because God is necessary, nothing else says why God is like what he is or can change what he does. He's not created, it's impossible for him to not exist. So he has no limit, and that again is part of being a necessary being. If he had something else outside that limited him, then that would be something that he depended on, as it were, that helped to explain God, and that would mean he wasn't necessary. So we've got another picture there. It's eternal without limit. And finally, if you think what he's made the laws of nature. The laws of nature are very elegant, very rational. It's very mathematical as well. Well, that means that God must know what it means to be rational. I mean, indicates mind and purpose. So by looking at the universe, when you go out at night, tonight, even in Coventry, almost certainly the night sky will be dark. Right? And when you look at that, that should remind you the universe is not infinitely old, it has a creator. And you can deduce from that, you've got a creator that's like this. And that's remarkably like the God of the Bible. Well, we often sound as though we're afraid of the idea of the Big Bang. In reality, the atheist should fear it, because it presses home the truth there was a time before which the universe didn't exist. And that shows the universe is contingent, that it requires a necessary entity to bring it into existence. And that necessary entity is identical with the God of the Bible. So far from being afraid of the idea of the universe, that science shows the universe began with a single creation event, we should actually be broadcasting that event to everyone we meet. Because the evidence for the Big Bang is powerful evidence for the existence of God. And now I finish.
I'd like on your behalf to thank John for his address, and we look forward to hearing shortly his words of exhortation also. God willing, the subject for next week's Bible Hour is the Dream of Empires, and we hope to have the company there of Brother Simon Genders from the Nottingham Forest Road Ecclesia. We'll conclude this meeting in a word of prayer, and I ask that after our refreshments we're back here for 11:10. So would you stand while we conclude the meeting? Great God, the creator and sustainer of all things, we thank thee again for this quiet time to consider thy word of truth, to be reminded of thy control of world events and of that lively hope of everlasting life that thou hast set before those who will listen and obey thee. To that end, we seek thy blessing as we depart, that we might consider our ways and each of us make our own calling and election sure. Hear our prayer and accept our thanks for this and for the daily refreshments and sustenance that thou dost provide. In Jesus' name, amen.